Welcome to The Contrarians, where we are right and you are wrong. I'm Julio.
And I'm Alex. Here on the show, we rage against the Rotten Tomatoes machine. For the first half of each episode, Contrarians Corner, we trash the fresh red tomatoes and praise the rotten green splotches, making our case any way we can.
The aptly titled Real Talk serves as the second half of each episode. This is where we discuss our true feelings on the movie we're covering. For more information on our podcast and to browse past episodes, you can head over to our website, wearethecontrarians.com.
From there, you can also access our Patreon and merchandise, because capitalism.
If you enjoy our attempts at comedic film discussions, we encourage you to subscribe and leave us a review on whatever podcatcher you use.
If you'd like to reach out to us directly, that's what social media is for. You can find us on most platforms as @ContrarianPrime.
You can also see what we look like if you go to youtube.com/@ContrarianPrime, and you can contact us by email at wearethecontrarians@gmail.com.
I think that covers it.
Then it's time for the podcast. And we are recording for Contrarians Corner for Kill Bill Volume 1.
Hello and welcome to The Contrarians, where we're right and you're wrong. My name is Alex, joined as always by my Peruvian cohort, Julio. We have a guest today as well, which Julio, I'll allow you to get to in just a moment. But returning? Have we done a Tarantino movie before?
Oh, like, I thought you were talking about our guest. And yes, Pulp Fiction.
Oh, duh, Pulp Fiction, way back in the day. So returning to our auteur and our guest are returning today, Quentin Tarantino, as we are here to discuss Kill Bill. I thought more divisive than its Rotten Tomatoes score would lead you to believe, 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. So as you could guess, we'll be cutting it down to size, pun intended, in the first half here, Contrarians Corner, and then we'll see how we really feel about it, because I think anyone that's ever talked to me about this movie already knows my thoughts on it, Julio especially. But Julio, it's not just going to be myself and you offering insight today. Who's jumping on board? Who's taking the flight to Tokyo with us?
Well, it was time. I mean, you could argue it's been time for a couple of years at least. Coming back from the much discussed, constantly referenced Terminator Compendium episodes that we did. Chaz Fisher from Draft Zero, from Australia, from Contrarians lore. You're part of the mythology, Chaz.
Oh, thank you.
We reference you constantly.
Lovely to be here. I feel, listening to your podcast, that the American Hustle episode gets referenced a lot more than the Terminator Compendium. I feel like you guys just punch me in the face every time. It's like, at least it's not as bad as American Hustle.
That is true. But we also, whenever we talk about something epic, we reference the Terminator episode. So it goes back and forth. I do think that your name comes up more with American Hustle. Terminator is just Terminator. But you were there. You were part of it. You were in a third of it.
I was there. Yeah. And we'll just try to completely forget about A Good Day to Die Hard.
Which we had to revisit recently, and it was nowhere near as much fun without you around. So it was brutal.
Oh, dude, it was awful.
I have a question, and please feel free to table this for real talk. But Julio, you know, initially you were like, Chaz, we want you back on the podcast. Give us some ideas from films. And I gave you some ideas and you just went, nah, we're not doing any of those. Let's do Kill Bill. So why did you want me in on a Kill Bill conversation?
So it was a confluence of circumstances. And Alex, I don't know how privy you are to any of this, even though you were part of that chat on Twitter. But so the main thing that you threw out, Chaz, was The Creator, which is a movie famously, I guess, if you follow me in Letterboxd, didn't like, and most of the people around the world seem to have liked, including you.
And I'm very middle of the road. I didn't dislike it.
Well,
I think I was a firm 3 out of 5.
The short version is, I don't think The Creator is worthy of having you over all the way from Australia. I think that it's a movie that, you know, we can discuss about how pretty it looks, and we can discuss about the things that I don't like about it. But some of those things are things that I think I've pointed out in other movies. And I don't think that any of us would be passionate enough about it to make for like a good episode, which if we were doing like weekly episodes with you, I think that would be fine. But I'm like, no, Chaz is coming back. It has to be a big deal. Also, this, if you're paying attention to our episode numbers, listeners, this one is 199, which means that Kill Bill Part 2, which will be our next episode, will be episode 200. So that made it, you know, I wanted something epic. It was like the last thing we did with you was the Terminator. You know, we did the entire series. So what could we do that would be that big on scope? And Kill Bill 1 and 2 seemed like a good idea. And those came to mind because, Alex, I was listening to something, or I was editing something on the Patreon, something that where you, as you tend to do, started talking shit about Kill Bill. And I remember, oh, that's right. Alex doesn't like Kill Bill. And we've been talking about how he should rewatch them, reassess them. And so it all clicked together. It's like, it's an opportunity to celebrate our 200th episode while also sticking it to my co-host, while also having fun with an old friend that's coming back to the show. Cool. So it just seemed interesting. And honestly, Chess, I don't think that you and I have ever talked about Kill Bill. So
I'm actually quite interested because I believe I know Alex's point of view, but I want to still know the extremes. Yeah, I can't wait for real talk. But yeah, Julio, you and I, we do not know how each other feels about this film. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I hadn't seen Kill Bill in a long time.
To be fair, there have been examples of me revisiting movies that I didn't like previously. Warrior, very famously. That's a bit different, though. I haven't seen these movies in 20 years, so it'll be interesting to see what the revisits bring. So, certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes with an 85% tomato meter score. That's factored in 238 reviews. The audience score 81%, and that's factoring in over 250,000 ratings. But we'll be sticking to the critics for this one, Julio. What quotes did you pull for us today?
We're going to start with Ethan Alter from NYC Film Critic, who says, "Perhaps the funniest thing about Kill Bill Volume 1 is the realization that this ode to ultraviolence and Uma Thurman's feet is probably Quentin Tarantino's most personal film." I'm going to open with, let's just get it out of the way. The feet thing. There's a lot of shots of Uma Thurman's feet and I guess other people's feet. I don't think it even crossed my mind that Tarantino had a foot fetish the first time I watched Kill Bill or any subsequent times. But now it's a thing. The Tarantino and feet, like that's a meme. It's just part of pop culture.
It never resonated with me until that shot Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when she's someone's daughter. I can't remember who right now. Well, everyone's someone's daughter, but she gets in Brad Pitt's car and then presses her feet up against the windshield. And it like is this wide shot that takes up like the focus of it. And I was like, oh, yeah, people are right.
Chaz, how do you, are people blowing it out of proportion, or do you agree that he does tend to focus on feet?
I mean, I think it just has me worried that I have a foot fetish because I just don't notice. So clearly I'm like, this is an appropriate amount of female feet in my movies.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I agree with you, Alex, and we might have even mentioned it when we were talking about that movie. I thought you were going to talk about the Margot Robbie shot where she goes to the movies and she puts up her feet, no socks, no shoes, like just the feet up on the, which is abhorrent behavior, especially for people like you and I that have worked in movie theaters. You don't do that. But no, there it is, yeah. Front and center. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the internet got in my head. I don't know if Tarantino really has a foot fetish. But this guy, if you're saying that it's his most personal film because of the ultraviolence and Uma Thurman's feet, then we know what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. Next, Andrew Saris from Observer says, "I would argue that in a bizarre way, Mr. Tarantino empowers women as no action genre director before him ever has." James Cameron.
Wow.
Cracking his knuckles.
Now, I did not remember, I mean, once I thought about it, yes, but it evaded me that there was nothing in between Jackie Brown and this. Obviously, Jackie Brown, female-driven film, female lead is our hero, I think that's the longest amount of time he's gone in between movies as well, or at least tied with any other breaks he's had. So as funny as it sounds now, because 20 years later a lot of critics of Tarantino say he can't write women and whatnot, and it's pretty awesome to think at one point in time they thought he was like this feminist filmmaker.
It's funny that you mentioned the big gap, Alex, because do you remember, either of you, both of you, how it was promoted, when it was just the trailer would open with the fourth film from Quentin Tarantino. Big blocky letters.
Oh, we are going to get to the credits whenever Contrarian Corners officially starts and we're out of quotes. We will spend some time talking about the credits.
Well, speaking of women, here's one. Emily Blunt might be, the actress might be just a blogger. Blunt from Blunt Review says, "QT's back and damned if the wait wasn't well worth it. Get ready for oodles of violence and swashbuckling humor." When I think of swashbuckling, I think of pirates. Not necessarily samurai. Am I wrong? Is there more of a scope to swashbuckling?
I think of Ashley Schaefer from Eastbound when he tells Kenny Powers, "Your swashbuckling shenanigans cost me my dealership." That's what I think of every time.
We got to close with Pierre Canavese from Groucho Reviews, who simply says, "Something borrowed, something bloody." Chaz, are you familiar with the romantic comedy Something Borrowed?
No, but I am familiar with the wedding tradition of Something Borrowed and Something Blue and Something New.
Oh man, you should see Something Borrowed, the Jennifer Goodwin vehicle with Kate Hudson as the vindictive best friend, and it's got John Krasinski as like the affable best friend. It's ridiculous.
It's really bad, but is it as bad as Kill Bill Volume 1?
So bad it's great.
Famously, Julio, myself, and his wife screened it together.
I think the power of that movie is in that I read Something Borrowed, Something Bloody, and that's what I think of. I don't think of, oh yeah, because she's getting married. But anyway, those were the quotes, Alex, Chaz. I think the table is set. Let's go into Contrarian's Corner.
This is me and my most masochistic.
Bill?
All right, as mentioned, the fourth film by Quentin Tarantino, with the old headers attached, that like feature presentation from the 70s that Tarantino probably just had in his personal collection. And I'm pretty sure the Draft House does that before every movie now. They I know there's a long stretch of time where they did. And
yep.
So Tarantino, once again, starting a trend that quickly became annoying and pretentious. Speaking of which, the opening of this movie is in black and white. In 1999, The Bride, a former member of the Deadly Viper assassination squad, is rehearsing her marriage at a chapel in El Paso, Texas. The Deadly Vipers, led by Bill, attack the chapel, shooting everyone as the bride lays wounded. She tells Bill that he is the father of her unborn child, just as he shoots her in the head. Now, in 2003, I assume this is exactly what people expected the opening frame of the fourth Quentin Tarantino film to be. Black and white, bloody woman getting shot in the head and viscera everywhere.
But instead of Mr. Lou, you get, is it called Bang Bang? Is that the name of the opening track?
Yeah. Nancy Sinatra version.
Yeah. Tarantino, three movies in, we knew that we could expect strong opening musical numbers. And this one is just so languid. I didn't like it. Just like I didn't like the fake quote at the beginning of of the movie.
Yeah.
The Klingon proverb. It made me realize that back when I watched Kill Bill for the first time, and probably two or three times since then, I used to think that that was really cool, that he was really funny and really inventive. It was like, you know, the old titles and the, you know, what you're talking like that feature presentation bit, and then the Klingon proverb, and he was just so geeky, but in a cool way. And then I don't know if it's that I'm older now, or is it that geeks in general are more mainstream, like they've taken over. So Tarantino doesn't stand out because he makes a Klingon joke. Like everybody's making Klingon jokes now, right? And so,
but
now-
also with this film, he's opening with a Klingon joke to say to me, "Don't take this seriously. Like we're about to go on a really fun romp." And then to your point, Alex, he opens with the static close up, black and white, you know, male monologue off screen. He both's like, "Don't take me seriously, but also I'm a really fucking big deal and you better take me fucking seriously."
Black and white, baby. Alex, what do you think? Tarantino, a nerd that has fallen out of style. Was he ever cool? Did we wise up to the fact that he was never cool? What's going on here?
I mean, he was always a dork, and I think he would admit that too. That's part of what makes him endearing to people like me, is because I hear him talking like, "Oh, he's just like me." And, you know, he has that very famous quote of, "I make my movies for myself." Like, and that's, you know, that's the dream right there, getting to a position where you can you know, if you look back to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this dude just got an amazing A-list cast just and made a movie for himself. That's admirable. That being said, he has gone too far into what he thinks is cool and doesn't really speak to the modern audience, or at the time modern. And I think this is kind of an example of that. 03, I mean, Madonna had a comeback going on. It should have been Madonna instead of Uma Thurman in here, man. I mean, like, imagine the possibilities. And, you know, the CG was starting to take over with things like Pirates of the Caribbean and whatnot. And he makes sure to do these really ridiculous practical effects that we'll get to in this that audiences at the time might have been gone over their heads, so to speak, or under, much like the katana does in this. Chaz, you had some qualms with the opening credits. What were they?
I mean, it follows on from that that Klingon quote. And this is where there might be some overlap between Contrarian's Corner and Real Talk, but this is Tarantino at his most indulgent, right? I can do whatever the fuck I want. I'm going to tell you in big letters that this is my fourth film, in case you can't count or haven't watched the other three. Up front, say, here's the deadly Viper assassination squad.
I'm going to number them. I'm going to give you the bullet points.
And like even the opening chapter one, and then underneath the number two, he's like, I'm so fucking smart. Everyone, like, just stop and pay attention. Like, this is how fucking great I am.
But it's our fault, right? Because we ate it up back then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, what can't he do? He did Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Reservoir Dogs, just whatever he threw our way, we were going to just take it. Did you feel cheated? I didn't remember this, but as the movie went on, it came back to me that we never see the massacre. They just tease it. They keep telling us, mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, you know, here's Lucy Luke kicking her in the face. Mm-hmm. But we never really see what happens. And if I remember correctly, we never do. Like, Volume 2 doesn't show us that either, right?
Okay, so what I'm hearing, Julio, is that you wanted more violence against women in this film, that Tarantino didn't quite get to the pinnacle of really, really tearing this woman apart.
Well,
that he
I'll tell
have.
You what I wanted. I wanted to see Uma Thurman put up a fight, because if I'm going to buy her as somebody that is a capable protagonist, somebody that's going to wake her legs up on her own from paralysis, I need to see that she was a badass from the beginning. And I don't see that. I just see her defeated. And then every time we get those flashbacks, it's to her getting her ass handed to her. So I think that if we had opened with the big set piece where she is pregnant, but she's still jumping and kicking, and she has her swords or nunchucks or whatever, and she's fighting these four people plus Bill plus what's her name, Sophie, on the phone in the corner, everybody there. You know, I just, that's an opening. That's, you know, J.J. Abrams Star Trek. It's like you open with a bang. You don't open with just this black and white weird close up and then Nancy Sinatra.
Julio, do you know who the RZA is?
I saw him in the credits.
So no.
In Julio's mild defense, I am also not super familiar.
I just, things that were like pertinent to pop culture of my childhood, knowing Julio was in a completely different country, I always like to bring up and be like, what? You don't know what that is? I mean, he's obviously way more than just someone who was in the Wu-Tang Clan, but that's what I mainly remember from my childhood. The Killer Bees, RZA was RZA, Jizza, Ghostface Killer, Method Man, Old Dirty Bastard. I don't know, I'm leaving some out, but the RZA was a prominent rap artist in the 90s, Julio. And then he went on to do scores for movies, this, of course, being one of them. What else? He's acted in some things as well. But that's just kind of one of those random Tarantino mashups that come out of nowhere that you're like, huh? I remember specifically in the lead into this movie, that was part of the intrigue from a lot of people, was the fact that he got RZA to do the music. So just a fun little sidebar there. Now, as far as the opening goes, I mean, the first time I saw it, it's a Tarantino movie, so I'm assuming the time frame is going to be all fucked up. So I just assumed we would get to it like a la Pulp Fiction at some point. Never happened.
Bang, bang. He shot me down. Bang, bang. I hit the ground. Bang, bang.
The bride falls into a coma In the hospital, Ellie Driver, one of the deadly Vipers, prepares to assassinate her via lethal injection. Bill aborts the mission, considering it dishonorable to kill her while she is getting defenseless. Now, before this, in Pulp Fiction fashion, in Tarantino fashion, we see her okay. And I honestly forgot it happens this early in the movie. This is, she goes to a home and we don't know whose it is. Knock on the door, answers it. Vivica A. Fox immediately leads into a fight scene, which obviously the big bloody crescendo at the end would be the quote unquote most famous scene. But I remember this one getting the most like talked about because it is so Tarantino-esque in that like they stop and there's dialogue and then, you know, it picks back up because the kid comes around. And
in terms of it dating, right, we've already talked about how, you know, his geekdom is perhaps drifting out of date. Did you guys also, I remember when I watched this in cinemas that I really loved that first knife fight with Vernica Green. But this time I was watching, I'm like, wow, they are just cutting around everything that was hard to do. And it's super choppy. It's like not choppy enough to be like good Bourne level shaky cam, but also like there's all these cool fight sequences. I think we've just been spoiled now with, but for a man who's like obsessed with Eastern cinema and amazing martial arts films, it's like, oh yeah, I can try and do that. And just never came anywhere close to those amazing long uncut sequences with incredible fight scenes.
I think in the era of John Wick and similar movies, then this doesn't feel anywhere near as revolutionary as it might have back in 2003. And it doesn't help that Tarantino's strength, or what used to be his strength, at least, you know, for those of us who are following his career, which was the dialogue, the conversations, it really, it's not even that it takes a backseat to the action here. It's more that it gets really dumbed down. Like, there's no Royal with Cheese monologue anywhere in this movie. You know, there's no gold watch
there's
monologue.
None of the, yeah, there's no memorable dialogue the way you could cite for almost every other Tarantino outing.
Out of everybody, I think Vivica Fox is the one that gets it the worst, because her sequence is just action and her calling Uma Thurman a bitch like 10 times. And that's it. Like, there's nothing clever about the wordplay. It really shakes you up. If you're, you know, you've watched his first three movies and you're like, okay, so what is it like when he starts doing action? And the answer is like, oh, he really dumbs down the dialogue. And now it just feels kind of generic. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's not terrible, but especially now that we've seen so much better, it's just very underwhelming. And I feel bad because I think, again, from my memory of Volume 2, everybody gets a chance to shine in a way in their respective chapters, each of the Vipers, except for Vivica Fox. Like, she is the one that kind of got screwed because she was just the opening salvo in this story. Yeah. So she's just there to show that Uma Thurman can, you know, can fight, but that's it.
Yeah.
And we get some more Tarantino universe building. I, at this point in my life, anytime I watch one of his movies, if there's a product, I take note of what it is to see if I see it again in any of the other movies. And it looks like Fruity Pebbles, essentially, but the cereal is called Kabooms, Kaboom. And they fly everywhere as Vivica A. Fox is just a god-awful shot, you know, from point-blank range. Yeah.
This is a super assassin.
Well, to be fair, five of these guys couldn't kill Uma Thurman while she was pregnant and while they caught her by surprise.
And yeah, she got shot point blank in the head and still made it. So I guess, yeah, to your point, that's valid.
Do you think all these guys have retired from being assassins? Like, they just were so bad at it that no one paid them to do anything anymore. And that's why they've all gone their separate ways. It's like 4 years later, the super assassin squad is like, yeah, I'm a housewife now. And I'm running a triad over here.
After the big failure at the chapel. Nope, no more.
Going their separate ways, then to return to a Quentin Tarantino movie 4 years later is pretty much the story of Michael Madsen's career. So...
Speaking of universe building, Alex, did you notice that the TV was playing one of the DiCaprio commercials from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
It's not true, but that's hilarious. If that was the case, they went back through and like Return of the Jedi'd it. They just superimposed some Rick Dalton TV show on there. But this is the only part in the movie where we hear Uma Thurman's character's name, the bride, and it's bleeped out in very artistic fashion.
I'm sure that will pay off in a fascinating way.
The dog, though, at their house was named Barney, so I popped huge for that because Barney was my best friend. That's a dog I used to have, and so that made me happy to hear.
I know. This Barney sounds like a pain in the ass, Alex.
Oh, yeah. He sounds like a real dick. My Barney was the fucking man. And as Uma Thurman leaves, not before killing this woman in front of her daughter and telling her daughter, if you're still mad about this when you grow up, you can come find me and we'll fight it out. Really healthy for the development of a four-year-old. She gets into a truck that it looks like Hulk Hogan, but then as she pulls away, it says Pussy Wagon on the back. And this is, now we go back to the coma and learn how she got that way. She awakens after 4 years in a coma and is horrified to discover that she's no longer pregnant. She kills a man who intends to rape her and a hospital worker who has been selling her body while she was comatose. Julio, it is the director's cut of Halloween all over again.
Yes, except that this time this one made it to theaters. What's his name? Michael Bowen? Is that the guy that plays Buck?
That's Buck. And then the gentleman who plays the truck driver or whatever, Jonathan Loran. I don't know if you recognize him, but he was like an Adam Sandler regular along with like Peter Dante and Alan Covert.
Oh, man.
They, you know, if you follow like the lineage of the Adam Sandler comedies through the mid to late 90s and early 2000s, those guys always had a part in it. So I did not remember that. And that was very upsetting.
Did they stop calling him after Kill Bill? We're like, no, we don't want to be associated with this.
Not to derail it, but Alex, you skipped over one important plot point, which is when she gets into the Pussy Wagon, she crosses out Vernica Green's name, and we see that Oren Ishii has already been crossed out, thus Tarantinoing himself to the point where you just don't give a shit about 60% of the movie.
Thank you, because she is in perfect condition.
This movie is divided into chapters, but they're completely out of sequence.
But I get what Chaz is saying. She doesn't even have a cut, I think, when she shows up at Vivica Fox's house. So you know that anything that happens between now and, you know, whenever she crosses off the first name, well, it doesn't have really any lasting repercussions. So there's no suspense in that big fight at the end, this, you know, last third of the movie, because we know she's going to be fine. She makes it to Vivica Fox's house. Now, Michael Bowen. I need to bring it up. No. I think that was a point that needed to be made. Just like we need to talk about Michael Bowen in the sense that maybe you guys disagree, but I think that this character, Buck, might be the most despicable, the most hateful character in the Tarantino universe. A universe that has Colonel Landa and has Mr. Blonde. But this guy, I mean, it's a gigantic piece of shit. He's a rapist. He's pimping her out while she's in a coma. Worst of the worst, which is like, that's fine. You know, it's like you want to write a despicable villain. But then, you know, he should be Bill. After I have Buck and Buck is disposed of in 5 minutes, I feel like that's where the movie peaked. Like, I don't really care about Bill, about Bud, and anybody else that she's going to run into, because the biggest person that she needed to take revenge against, I think she already took care of. Like, she smashed his head with the door.
How did this guy has a knuckle tattoo that spells out fuck, and he got hired at a hospital?
I mean, look, I'm an Australian, so watching this, I'm like, yes, that's how the US healthcare system works.
Fair.
You're not too far off.
Sorry, that was a cheap shot.
That is a deserved shot.
Warranted.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, Michael Bowen, just topping the list, I think, of Tarantino villains, maybe villains in general. And I don't know, just after he's there and he makes such a nasty impression, what can anybody else do in this movie? Everybody else just seems like, oh, well, they're minions.
I mean, at this point, Tarantino's only made 4 movies. And he's gotten to the point where he's already referencing his own movie, right? We've got Uma Thurman jerking upright, right?
Yes.
Awake, right? But instead of a shot of adrenaline, she's been in a coma for 4 years, and it's a mosquito that happens to, you know, I mean, I hate mosquitoes as much as the next person, but if that's going to be what wakes me from a coma and not anything else, I don't know. The medical science, I'm not sure, stacks up on this one.
It is the Tarantino-verse. She gets that, you just reminded me, that she sits up and she gets her Oscar scene. And this is, enjoy it, because it doesn't happen again. This is it. This is where they let her act. The rest of the movie is just her kicking and running and swinging a sword. But Uma Thurman is a good actress, so she can sell it. It's kind of the movie all this emotion that she's projecting, at least this volume, it really lets it down, because next time we see her, like, she never shows this level of grief again. Through the rest of the movie, she's kind of smiling. It's like, take it to Okinawa, please. Take it to wherever I'm going next. She's a tourist. She's having a blast in this revenge journey. It's almost like two different movies, right? Like the one about the woman that wakes up and finds out that her pregnancy is gone. And then the cartoon that follows.
Wiggle your big toe. Wiggle your big toe.
Well, the main event comes here about 30 minutes into the movie when we have like this 10-minute sequence of Uma Thurman trying to get her big toe to wiggle. Just shots of her feet over and over. And I mean, I like the idea that she gets the big toe to move and she's like, all right, the hard part's over. And then, you know, it kind of cuts to her walking. But she takes a hospital worker's truck and gets herself back in shape, vowing to kill Bill and the other deadly vipers. Looks like our friends at Wikipedia wrote the plot summation sequentially, which would have been helpful. Take some notes, Quentin.
But can I point out, in terms of like the time sequence, she's got the pussy wagon still at Vernica Fox. And that's after she has left the hospital, gone to Okinawa, trained for a month, gone to Tokyo, and Alex will talk you through what happens in Tokyo, come back like 6 months later and she's still picked up the pussy wagon, which happens to be like the vehicle of a murdered nurse in a hospital.
It just grew on her.
Like, why is she hanging on to the car? Does Tarantino just love that car so much? He's like, yep, I would drive that thing everywhere.
I didn't even think about that, but yeah, like, she just left it at the overnight lot at LAX for 3 weeks while she was over in Japan.
She comes back, the cops are all over it.
No shit. The bride then goes to Okinawa to obtain a sword from legendary swordsmith Hattori Hanzo, who has sworn never to forge a sword again. Now, this whole thing, like, if we're talking about just watching the movie, once her big toe wiggles, this movie just becomes the Lucy Liu side quest. And it's just long, long, long format scenes. And so if you're liking what you've watched up until this point, I got bad news for you, because the rest of the movie is not going to be like it.
There is an extended origin sequence in animated form for Lucy Liu. And I, again, going back to what it was like to watch this movie in theaters, I remember being blown away. I was like, holy shit, he just put a cartoon in the middle of his movie. Watching it today, I was like, this is just like the rest of the movie. Like, what's the point of having a 10-minute animated sequence when what comes before and what comes after is just as exaggerated and it's just as stylized? Like, it really felt like they could have done it live action, the secret origin of Lucy Liu, and it would have felt about the same. Like, maybe, you know, a lot more squibs, like the blood geysers would have to be, you know, more manageable. But still, like, it didn't really feel like it served a purpose.
Well, also, the action sequences in the animation were better than the ones that he'd shot with Vernica Fox. So I'm like, oh, Tarantino, you've got your animators to do what you couldn't do with your directing talent.
I was struggling through that whole sequence, man. And it's kind of odd saying this about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I think, is literally an hour longer than this. But their backstory building is so much more efficient. Specifically, you know, Brad Pitt's former wife in that. You don't know if he killed her or not, but we see kind of some little concise clips that allow the viewer to kind of reach their own conclusion. This, man, I was having a hard time.
There's no ambiguity here. It's like, you know for sure those people are dead.
Well, yeah, and it's also just like, this is definitely someone making a movie for themselves and not thinking about the general audience at large. It's like, hey, I'm just going to take this side diversion and make like a cartoon that would have aired on MTV in the fucking late 90s at 1 a.m. And that's... That's cool, man, but don't expect me to agree with you about it.
The sandwich between the Max and Space Ghost Coast to Coast. Here's Lucy Liu's origin story.
Man, I was going to reference the Max, and I thought that was going to be too deep of a cut. So, Julio, same wavelength there. I like it. And then we lead into just an insanely over-the-top Japanese caricature. I could understand some people getting offended at this because he's like, you know, he's really an Asian actor and shit, but some of the dialogue delivery was like approaching Breakfast at Tiffany levels.
Oh, you're talking about Hanzo, right?
Hattori,
yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, the other thing that is dated since this movie is that I don't think white men are allowed to do this anymore. Like, there's a line between homage and cultural appropriation, and I think we all know which side Kill Bill Volume 1 falls on. He's like, I just wish I was Asian, and I'm not.
And Serpentino saying, look, I don't care. It made money. I'll keep doing it. He made a whole second part to this movie that was... even worse. I'll bring it up next episode, but I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that he had originally planned to play the sensei, or, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But yeah.
Good God.
This Okinawa sequence, my thought was like, oh, yes, the Empire Strikes Back. And this is Yoda. And he's pretending to be just this affable, harmless bar owner. And then, of course... eventually, he starts speaking backwards, reveals his real self. And that's it. I guess Uma Thurman had to do was say the magic word, Bill, and then she gets a sword. There's a struggle here.
Yeah. After learning her target is Bill, his former student, he crafts his finest sword for her. Essentially, in Pulp Fiction, they accomplish the same thing in 30 seconds as they did in 25 minutes here, where Bruce Willis just looks up on the shelf and he goes through the different options for weaponry and then finds a katana and is like, ah, yeah, this will work.
Alex, I actually listened to our Pulp Fiction episode in preparation for this recording because I wanted to just make sure we didn't repeat ourselves. And I posit the theory that the katana that Bruce Willis grabs at the pawn shop is Uma Thurman's katana from Kill Bill. So we've come full circle.
Hell yeah.
Can we just, like, in between her magically getting the sword because she doesn't say Bill, she just infers Bill,
right,
and getting to Tokyo and the rest of the shebang that is the rest of the film, there's a model plane, like, that is so deliberately a model. I felt for a second I was watching a Wes Anderson movie because it's shot all square on with like painted backgrounds and the plane. She's like looking out of the plane and following her enemy driving along the Tokyo streets from like, I don't know, 20 meters up or something. And it's all so stylized. And I was just like, why? Why does she then get on a motorbike? Like, we're getting into the Tarantino foot fetish thing here. He is just like, yeah, I wanted to see her on a motorbike, right? And driving around the streets. It's absolutely, you could have cut straight from her getting the sword to her showing up at the restaurant, and you would have saved 20 minutes of absolute nothing.
To be fair, people confuse Wes Anderson and Quentin Tarantino quite often because they do have similar interests and aesthetics.
I thought it was like the shot in Wayne's World that was deliberately trying to be funny. They're like, well, they're flying us over to London. And it's like a fucking plane on a string flying across. That's
so the movie opened with this quote about revenge and, you know, how it's a dish best served cold. And I guess as a starting point for a revenge movie, I mean, that's all right. That's solid. And then usually what you would do is you would explore what it's like to take revenge and the toll it takes on the person that's doing the revenging. And that doesn't really happen here. I mean, this is just action wall to wall, you know, other than that one moment that we singled out with Uma Thurman. And it's action and style and just Tarantino indulging himself on like, oh, well, how can I make this look cool? And how can I make this sound cool? And so on. It is weird on the heels, well, for us, we're recording a little out of order, but, you know, on the heels of having watched a bunch of Nicholas Winding Refn movies and having talked about Harmony Korine's output on the Patreon channel. And now we get to Tarantino, who arguably, not even arguably, I mean, I think categorically, is far more recognized and far more celebrated than both of those filmmakers. But still, when you get to it, you know, this movie of his, it's just style. It's not even style over substance. It's just style. there's the promise of substance at the beginning, but it doesn't happen. Like, am I missing the inner journey of the Uma Thurman character? Was there something that she did in Okinawa where we could tell like there was an inflection point in her character, and that's why she got the sword? Like, did she learn to say please? What's going on here? Is it just as two dimensional as it seems to me?
Yes.
Why should I help you?
Because my vermin is a former student of yours.
When you read out that quote, like, this is Tarantino's most personal film ever, like, no, it's not. There's no depth to this whatsoever. This is, we're all going to sit down and watch a mediocre homage to much better other cultural cinema output.
That's the thing, right? Like, that's what, I guess, what he would tell you. It's like, oh, well, if you want to get it, just watch those kung fu movies I like, and then you'll see that this is, that's the real meaning. The layer is that we're celebrating that, not that we care about what happens to this poor woman that we just put through the ringer.
I mean, Tarantino has arguably just made in volume one, a 2-hour movie trailer for Eastern cinema. It's like, if you found this vaguely interesting, there's a whole lot of better stuff over there. I mean, is it, genuine question, is this better or worse in cultural appropriation stakes than Dances with Wolves? Because we've just got a white woman up and out-samuraiing, you know, the triad, and I don't know. Yeah, it's just like, if you're blonde and white and you have pretty feet, then you are clearly going to be better than everyone else at everything.
It's such a letdown too, because Uma Thurman, Mia Wallace has, you know, maybe a tenth of the screen time in Pulp Fiction, but her character had feelings there that were explored, and that, you know, there was a push and pull with the Travolta character, and you could see that there was something there. Here, the bride is just laser focused on killing these people, and that's kind of it. So, I mean, I don't blame anybody that gets bored. So you checked out, Alex, during the middle. Did you somehow manage to check back in once she lands in Tokyo?
The funny part is, for all those things Chaz is saying about appropriation and, you know, the whitewashing of it and just the kind of overwhelming gall of a lot of this movie, it's still just really boring. You know, you hear all that and you're like, you're like, oh man, that at least might be like fascinating to watch in some capacity. I'm here to tell you, just like, here specifically, you think it's going to get exciting. She, bride travels to Tokyo to find another deadly viper, Oren Ishii, now the leader of the Tokyo Yakuza. After witnessing Yakuza murder her parents when she was a child, Oren took vengeance on the Yakuza boss and replaced him after training as a lead assassin. All right, cool. Let's see what happens. Oh, it's 10 minutes of exposition and these people like eating at a table that eventually leads to, I mean, which at the time was probably the moment I remember a lot of people talking about, some would-be business associate comments on Lucy Liu. Coming from American, Chinese, and Japanese descent, she gets a fucking katana, cuts this dude's head clean off, fountain of blood shoots up, not unlike things you would see in 70s kung fu style movies. And, you know, I would fully believe that Tarantino, that's like the moment in the movie that he started with. And he's like, all right, I just got to build around this. We got to get there and we'll figure it out when we get there. But we'll figure everything else out, I should say. But we're going to get there.
This is post Charlie's Angels, Lucy Liu. So, you know, she has something to prove. She delivers that Oscar scene that she has where she just goes on and switches back and forth in different languages and, you know, just blood splattered and she's smiling, but then she's threatening. All that. You know, she's thinking about Bill Murray the entire time. She's just like, I'm going to show this fucker.
I was going to say she was out to prove him wrong. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's not her fault. I mean, you know, it's like she, I think that much like what we're talking about with the Uma Thurman Oscar clip, I think that this movie sets her up. That scene is like, all right, this is a good starting point. Where do we go from here? Oh, to you getting killed at the end with no real exploration of your issues of how do you feel? I mean, that is an intriguing character, right? Like somebody that's considered an outsider by mm-hmm. her culture takes over this criminal operation, and she decides that she's going to rule by fear. She's going to show them. And it's like, all right, how is this going to pan out? Like, you know, you're introducing all these elements. Surely it has to be somewhere more complex than just a sword fight between a bunch of people at the end. But it doesn't. That's it.
I was surprised to see how short the runtime was of this movie, because I remember it feeling long, even from my memory. And watching it again now, not only could you have like got rid of all the rubbish into her getting to the restaurant, then why do we have her like trying to hide in the restaurant from Oren and then sneaking into the bathroom to what? Unzip her jacket and then coming out just to fucking summon her using the PA system. Like, can we just miss the 10 minutes of build up to her just yelling, "Hey, Oren, I am here."
Showmanship. Yeah, it's really silly also that she's trying to be inconspicuous when she first arrives. So she's dressed in this yellow jumper and she is a white blonde woman. So how does she go undetected to begin with? And then also, yeah, what's the point? Just pull a Batman, just crash through the skylight, land there with your sword, and that's how you get their attention.
What was that? The bride's yellow outfit was inspired by the outfit worn. I knew it was a Bruce Lee. I was looking up the name of the movie. It was Bruce's final movie, Game of Death from 1978. Any imagery I have of Bruce Lee in my head, I always come back thinking of that yellow suit he wears.
Well, not anymore, Alex. So. Now that's Uma Thurman's suit.
Now, which version did you guys watch of Kill Bill Volume 1? Because I watched the theatrical release where Tarantino, for all his self-indulgence and saying, "I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want," completely chickened out and turned the crazy 88 scene into black and white just so that he would avoid being an unrated.
Okay, that's what I watched. I've heard that I didn't know there was an actual, like an official release that where he got rid of the black and white.
I think it's called The Whole Bloody Affair, where he's like joined it into two films.
Oh, yeah, no.
And it's in color. But there was no like zero artistic decision-making around turning that sequence black and white. That is a pure commercial, all right, I'm just going to do what other people tell me
My note says, why black and white? Really, there's no reason. I'm sure you knew that, right, Alex?
No, I didn't. I thought it was like an artistic decision, but that makes a lot of sense too, because this... it's obviously a bloodletting of a sequence, and the MPAA is nothing if not hyper-hypocritical. I could almost say that alliteratively. But before we get there, we get the sequence that, like, I don't know if y'all remember this. This might have been an American thing, but, like, it just fucking took off. What is the name of that song? Battle Without Honor or Humanity? That bam, bam, bam. So that sequence, like, that was everywhere for a few years. I remember, like, in college, like, in commercials and shit, that song was used everywhere. And just that way of, like, the rapid cuts to the beat of the music. Obviously, Tarantino didn't invent that, but that scene was, like, one of the main thing people took away to ape and, you know, use for their material.
It's funny how it works, though, because I thought that song played at a cool moment in the movie. I thought it was gonna be like during the fight.
Just walking.
They're just walking. That's it. I thought it was in the middle of the fight that you were gonna get that score. But no, it's just them walking in slow motion, and I guess Uma Thurman is watching them across the street or something.
To the point now, and this isn't any fault of the movies, obviously, but like I kind of just laugh when I hear that because it's been cliched to death in my brain. That was something. I had a roommate. My roommate shut down Brown in college. Like that was like a joke we did. Like if someone was taking a long time to like walk to the octagon in a UFC fight or like the ring for wrestling, we would start like jing 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 jing.
So. Let's bring it
I
back.
I did forget
Alex.
The use of. Yes, I did forget the use of that. Tarantino. I guess that would be a compliment. He is so exuberant in his use of music that you sometimes forget songs that he uses. Now, I did laugh at the small fella with the yellow robe and the black sash because he was bald. They were calling him Charlie Brown. I thought that was pretty funny. But man, my note just has bored in all capital letters here. It's just so much talking. And when we do get to the old boy scene, it's just kind of like, all right, because then it just becomes self-parody by the end.
But there's levels, right? Like, I mean, I'm not saying that any of them is particularly interesting, but he has this attempt at, because you have a couple of mini bosses, right? You have the original set of minions, then you have the high school girl with the, what do you call it? Like that ball and chain that she uses. Is that, I guess just a ball and chain? Is that what you call it?
You know, maybe a, like a modified mace or something.
Morningstar.
I think that
yeah, Morningstar.
There's actually a name for the long chain weapon, but that is like one of the best shots in the movie, and it is hyper violent. Shocker is you don't see her make contact, and you don't see what's in her head. You just kind of see her with tears of blood. I was like, that's pretty cool.
The MPAA goes, course, like, okay, you can have that one in color.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. Any man ass though, you're out of here.
and then you get the crazy 88, and then you get one guy that's all introduced as being kind of like a big deal, but she gets rid of him in like 5 minutes. So there should be an escalation. Like I should feel an escalation, but it all feels the same in a way. Even the girl with the maze, the Morningstar, what have you. I mean, it doesn't feel like it's a different enough style to where I can feel that there's two types of video games. The ones where every level is different and you feel engaged every time. And then there's the ones where every level is the same, like Space Invaders, Pac-Man. You know, this is Pac-Man. You finish with one wave of attackers, and now it's like the next one is just more of the same, only, you know, faster. Entire time, Lucy Liu at the top, smirking. It's like Donkey Kong in the old Donkey Kong game where, you know, you have to reach the top. It's and it goes on. Like I checked, it's like 30 minutes of movie at the end.
Yeah, that's like as soon as you get to Tokyo, the movie's like you're there. Have fun. And Julio, I don't know if you're intentionally like beating around the bush here, but you're missing the obvious point. Matrix Reloaded came out 6 months before this.
Oh, boy.
Full color. There's no black and white there.
There is no black and white. I can't even make a joke about the Matrix Reloaded looking good, though.
So, Alex, gun to your head. Do you have to sit through the architect's speech at the end of Matrix Reloaded or Lucy Liu's Oscar scene here?
I mean, this, because jokes aside, and this bleeds into real talk, the practical effects are dope, and that fucking fountain of blood is just like, hell yeah. The architect. Is, now, that's I will say this, guy. When I pulled... Yeah. But I... when I pulled this up here to verify the release date on it, it only says that The Matrix Reloaded is 2 hours and 20 minutes, and in my mind, that movie's like 5 hours long. And then when I watched this today, it flew by, so I guess that Kill Bill has that over this, even if it did like completely steal its climatic scene. And Julio, I knew you would love the part where they both simultaneously say tricks are for kids, because Lucy Liu calls her silly rabbit.
It was. There's a lot of moments like that of just cringe here that... Like I said at the beginning of Constraints Corner, I felt that my recollection is that I thought that it was at the very least amusing. And most of the time, I think I thought it was clever back then in 2003. And now it just feels like, ugh, what is this? It's just a big miss. And probably encapsulating that feeling is when this big battle against the Crazy 88 ends with Uma Thurman spanking one of the, the bodyguards. What's going on here, Alex?
But I have just my notes here. It's the old boy sequence. But of course, it's not anywhere near as cool as old boy because it's not one continuous shot. And I have a note here that says, I get it. She wants to kill Lucy Liu because it kind of drags out there at the end. And we end up in the snow for the final sequence, the final battle. And she ends up taking the top of her head off. That's kind of ingrained. That's like one of those Tarantino things I think of, because they're in their sword fight. There's, you know, an off-screen slash, and we see what you think is her entire head fly off and into the snow, but it's really just the top of her head.
And then she gets the Kevin Pollak death from Ricochet. When she goes, I guess yes. It was a Hanzo sword.
And she falls to her knees while fucking... Uma Thurman is still in slash pose, like she's Chris Jericho with her back to Lucy Liu as she falls. And it's let me get through the plot here. The bride tracks Oren Ishii to a restaurant where she amputates the arm of Oren's assistant, Sophie Fatale. The bride defeats Oren's squad of elite fighters, the Crazy 88, and kills Oren's bodyguard, the schoolgirl Gogo Yubari. Oren and the bride duel in the restaurant's Japanese garden. The bride kills Oren by slicing off the top of her head. The bride tortures Sophie for information about the other deadly vipers and leaves her alive as a threat. Chaz, who's the French gal here? Is she of any note? Julie Dreyfus? Not Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but...
I wish.
Yes. I was like, that name sounds familiar. No, I do not know off the top of my head, Alex. But I would say, like, I was wondering whether this film actually passes the Bechdel test, because we've got nothing but women all throughout the film, and all they can fucking talk about is Bill.
For shame. That's... Speaking of Bill, though, so we never see him. Like, we know that he exists. The movie's called Kill Bill. She says she's going to kill Bill. We know it's David Carradine. Like, that was not something that was hidden from us in the promotional materials, in the, you know.
Nor in the 6-foot-tall credits at the beginning of the movie.
Exactly. Why is he trying to make it mysterious? Because by the time, again, jumping a little bit ahead to volume 2, by the time that we see Bill, he looks just like David Carradine. It's not that, oh, well, he's not showing us what he looks like because it's going to be a wild departure from what we're used to when we think of David Carradine. It's exactly what David Carradine looks like. So what's the point of being mysterious about him? He speaks the same way. He has the same cadence. And he looks just like he just stepped out of the set of Camille.
Jesus.
It was. I don't remember how disappointed I was when we got to the end of Kill Bill Volume 1 and there was no Bill at all, like other than background. Do you guys remember? Were you, or were you just disappointed by all their stuff? And it was like, I don't care about Bill. There's bigger problems here.
I remember waking up from my nap.
I must have missed Bill.
It was obviously deliberate that it was called Volume 1, even though, you know, I was fucking, 16 or 17 when this came out? Even I could still see, oh, it's going to be a two-parter. So, you know, I was just kind of checked out by this point anyway. But if you're into it, I guess the takeaway is that the big cliffhanger is he asked the French gal, does she know her daughter's still alive? Mm-hmm. And we may not see Bill, but we know that there's going to be a baby, hopefully a talking baby in the sequel.
A pretty perplexing strategy from the bride to basically relay her plans to Bill via this French woman that now is armless. I think that did she cut both her arms or just one?
I think there was one. A threat to cut the other arm off, but okay. I think as she rolled down the snow, she appeared to have at least one arm remaining.
Okay, so she folded really quick.
It was not only God forgives, she got to keep one of the arms.
Okay, well.
I love it how like the French woman, Sophie Fatale, was just like, I will never tell you anything to the woman with the samurai sword. And the first thing she threatens to cut off, she's like, all right, I'll tell you. Like,
yeah, she survives to tell us what the sequel is going to be about and to just deliver that message from Thurman. And I was like, what's the plan here? Now they know you're coming. And last time I'm going to reference Volume 2, they're ready for her in Volume 2.
And again, this is where, like, you know, Pulp Fiction, the out-of-sequence storytelling is unbelievable, right? But in this, first of all, the, you know, right after the first chapter, it ruins the rest of the movie. So there's no tension, even if it weren't boring. And then also, why the fuck is Wernicke not ready? They
true.
Know that the bride has just slaughtered 100 people with a samurai sword. And she's just like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, hang around home with my, waiting for my daughter to come home and not be prepared in any way for this.
She hadn't checked her texts.
Left on red.
Yeah. She had blocked Sophie. She's like, oh, no. She wants to borrow money again. There's that final voiceover, I guess it's Hanzo, right, that we hear at the end, and he's trying to justify the structure of the movie by going that revenge is never a straight line. You always wander off and you digress, meander, go through an animation 10-minute sequence and so on. I was like, all right, that's I feel the rationalization, but I just don't feel the emotion behind it. I think that if the path of revenge was as twisted and complicated as that voiceover tells us, then I would feel that Uma Thurman is a lot more conflicted about this by the time that we reach the end of Volume 1. But she's not. She's just ready to cross off the next name on her list. I mean, it's just right where we started.
On to the next one.
Yeah, on to the next one, which will be 30 minutes longer.
But before we can move on to the next one, I think there's some real talk that needs some dispensing of. So, Julio, Chaz, are we ready to move along?
Let's do it.